Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. Thank you for joining me today for another opportunity to have a wonderful, in-depth conversation about a topic that I know you are all going to be really profoundly fascinated with. Today, we have the opportunity to talk to Dr. Susan Brown. And Dr. Susan Brown is an inspiration for me personally. We go back a while, and she has been such a great teacher about the world of bones and osteoporosis. And that is what we're going to be exploring today. We're going to be debunking the myths about osteoporosis. We're going to look at what's really going on regarding our bones, our bone health, and what we really need to do to ensure healthy bones throughout our entire life. And this really is the passion and the work of Dr. Susan Brown, who has really devoted many, many, many years to exploring the truths about our bone health and putting together the best strategies to help us regain our bone and to, of course, give us the knowledge so we can prevent loss as early as possible. She's the author of some phenomenal books. I recommend everyone read her books, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But I just want to share with you some of Dr. Brown's background. Dr. Susan Brown is a medical anthropologist, a New York State certified nutritionist, and the author of Better Bones, Better Body, the first comprehensive look at natural bone health. She has more than 20 years of experience in clinical nutrition, bone health research, and lay-in health professional education. She has consulted widely on socioeconomic, cultural, educational, and health issues. Dr. Brown has taught in North and South American universities and authored numerous academic and popular articles. We could say a whole lot more about what Dr. Susan Brown has accomplished, but I think it is best to let us begin this conversation because we have so much to share with you today. So it's my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Susan Brown to the show. Hello, Susan.
Hello, Cheryl. How are you doing today?
I'm good. And, you know, I alluded to the fact that we have known each other for actually several decades now.
Yes.
And you have always been such a pioneer. You're right there at the leading edge of this knowledge relating to our bones, and I am so grateful to you for all the wisdom you've shared with me over the years and how I have been able to apply it personally and go on and share it in the work that I do. So it's always such an honor to have you on the show. So glad you can be with us today.
Thank you very much, and it's always great to share some of these new ideas and some of the old ideas to remind us how we can better preserve our skeletons and stay strong. So let's just look and see what we can bring up of interest today.
Well, how about if we start with some of the common myths that surround bones and this thing called osteoporosis so we can get the facts straight?
Yeah, let's just run through some of the common myths. The first one, of course, everyone's going to recognize the idea that calcium is the problem, that osteoporosis is caused by a lack of calcium. And years ago, in my book, Better Bones, Better Body, I pointed out that this simply isn't true, because if you even just look around the world, you'll see that some of the cultures with the lowest calcium intakes have better bone health, which is measured, of course, by fracture incidence, that have less fracture even though they have much less calcium. In fact, it's now been documented that the countries with the highest calcium intakes, like the U.S., have the highest hip fracture rate. So there's much more going on than just calcium. And even though we have spent millions, I dare say billions of dollars, trying to show that calcium and a lack of calcium is what causes osteoporosis, it's simply not true. You certainly need a minimum amount of calcium, and this might just be 800 or 900 milligrams in our culture, although our government has said we should have 1,200 milligrams of calcium in diet and supplements, and that's a really good guideline. And most people probably need 600 or 700 in supplements depending on their diet. So calcium is not the cause of osteoporosis, low calcium, for the vast majority of people. And, of course, this invites us to look at all the other nutrients And one of the major contributions we have made is to point up there that there are at least 20 key bone nutrients. And if people go to our website, which is betterbones.com, we have a vast discussion of each one of these nutrients, whether it's manganese, zinc, copper, boron, vitamin C, the importance that all of these have for bone health. I just attended a recent conference on osteoporosis and nutrition, an international symposium. And, you know, it's so interesting. We're starting to realize, the researchers are starting to realize, it's not just one nutrient, but it's all the nutrients together. And in many situations, one nutrient will compensate for the other. If you're lower in, one of the interesting studies was with vitamin C, that they found that vitamin C actually reduced fracture by about 44% amongst the people who had higher vitamin C intakes. And this was only like 200 to 300 milligrams, either in food or in supplements a day. And they found that when they looked at certain populations like the men, that if they were low in vitamin E and low in calcium, that the vitamin C would compensate and help make up, help preserve bone, even with low levels of other antioxidants like vitamin E and low levels of calcium. So all the nutrients work together, and ideally we'd like to get a balance of all these key nutrients, and certainly in the products I produce and the materials we promote, we look at all the essential bone nutrients. And as I mentioned, you can find details on these at betterbones.com. That's one really big common myth. There's quite a few myths, Cheryl. Should we do one or two other ones right now?
Yes, I just want to say it's amazing how adaptive the body is. You know, like you were saying, that the body has this a certain capacity to compensate when we are missing nutrition. I would say up to a point, but that's, you know, our goal is really to provide the complete nutrition for the body. But it does have this wiggle room where we can get away with certain deficiencies for a period of time.
Exactly. And one of the interesting versions of the wiggle room is that we also titrate. It's like our little computer within us says, well, if you're only giving me so much vitamin D, what am I going to use it for? And you're always going to use it for the most important things first. So vitamin D you will use first for calcium absorption, because you will die if your blood calcium is not stable. And so the body says, oh, we got to put this vitamin D here. Then it says, and if there's enough, we're going to use it then to actually reduce inflammation. We're going to use it to produce an antibiotic, a natural antibiotic, which will protect us against infection. We're going to use it to boost the immune system. We're going to use it to strengthen muscles. So we know the same thing is with vitamin K, and I'm sure we'll find out with all the nutrients. The body so wisely decides how, what's the most important use of that nutrient, and if we have a scant supply, it's going to titrate it out. And like you mentioned, the ideal state is where you have very complete replenishment of all the nutrients. And in fact, one of my projects...
Can I just jump in before you move on?
Yeah.
I just have this one question, because you were such a pioneer with the awareness of vitamin D many, many years ago before it's become so popular. But my question is this, because vitamin D is prioritized by the body, is this the reason why we find it necessary to go for optimal levels of vitamin D when we get our blood tests done to look at our vitamin D levels, because then it can be used in all the different functions of the body and have optimal levels for all those functions to occur?
Well, that's right. That's right. You'd want to, so long science has looked at just one impact. Oh, vitamin D is only important to prevent rickets, for example, which is the disease you get if you don't have enough calcium absorption, the very severe disease. But now we realize, wow, there's receptors for vitamin D on practically every organ. That's right. That's exactly right. So we want to have an optimum dose so that all the body's requirements for vitamin D can be met.
Okay, good. Yeah, interesting. Okay, let's go on to more of those myths.
Yes, if we distract on vitamin D too long, we could spend the whole hour because it's fairly fascinating. But
yeah.
And with vitamin D, we say at the Center for Better Bones, we're striving for a 50 to 60 in blood NG level. Mm-hmm. Probably a 40 to 60 is fine. And we know that indigenous populations that live out in the sunlight in the tropics have a 40 to 50 level. We know there's great protection against cancer, diabetes, heart disease. It's a fascinating nutrient. And people who want more information can go to grassrootshealth.net as well as to our website. But let's go back to one other myth that I really think is still so important. And this is the concept that osteoporosis is something that has gone wrong with the bones or something that's gone wrong with the body. And if you take the broader perspective, if you step back and look at this from a system-wide, from the whole body system, you see that osteoporosis is really a very positive coping mechanism. It's like the long-term negative effect of a very important and essential short-term coping mechanism. And again, we're talking about the importance of delivering all the nutrients to the bone, all the nutrients to the body, I should better say. And if we don't give all the nutrients, then we're going to have to go into survival mode. What happens in osteoporosis is in youth, we naturally build strong bones. We build a lot of bone density, a lot of bone strength. Just within the teen years between adolescence and the end of teens, we put down probably half of our bone mass. It's a natural, spontaneous thing. We don't do anything to, we don't do any special supplements or tricks to the trade to do that. But when, as we, and that is because bone serves many important functions. Not only gives us structure and allows us to walk and have a, be mobile, but it also is a great storehouse for nutrients. And so in bone, we store calcium, some magnesium, some potassium, and carbonates and alkalizing compounds. So we see that osteoporosis is really the end result when we've drawn on these bone reserves for too long of a period of time. And the most fascinating bone reserve to me is not calcium, although calcium has to be precise in the blood or we'll die. And so bone serves as that reservoir. And should we get very low in calcium, the body will always take it out of the bone and keep the system alive. But the most fascinating aspect of what bone stores to me are these alkalizing compounds. That minerals in bone are attached to what they call negatively charged particles, anions. And these anions are often alkalizing compounds that can remove excess acid from the body, like carbonates, citrates, ascorbates, fumarates. Perhaps we don't appreciate the fact that minerals just don't stand alone. You just don't have calcium by itself in the body, or potassium or magnesium. It's attached to something else. That something else it is attached to can be acid-forming or alkalizing. It can remove acid from the body or add acid. And this is crucial because pH balance is extremely important. You know, I mentioned the blood has to have a specific level of calcium. Well, it also has to have a very specific pH. It has to be slightly alkaline. I think the figure is something like 7.35. And as you remember from your chemistry, 7 is neutral. So you slightly alkaline or you really will die very quickly. And so the body says, first thing I've got to do is maintain pH balance. And that pH balance is maintained largely by calling upon bone when the body has too much free acid rolling around its system. So when we say osteoporosis is something gone wrong, we say, well, maybe that's not really true. Maybe it's the body's attempt to do the best it can to survive when we put it under very demanding circumstances, when we don't give it enough nutrients, when we don't give it the right environment to prosper. It's going to go and look, where are these nutrients? Where are the alkalizing reserves? How can I get the body back into balance? And it's a very interesting thing. The book I just wrote was The Acid Alkaline Food Guide, and it talks about how foods can actually affect your pH. And while this is a complicated story, just to say in short terms, the food we eat can make a difference. It can create an acidic tilt, and our bones must be used to buffer that acidic tilt. And so rather than seeing osteoporosis as something gone wrong, we can see it as a very positive coping mechanism that the body has developed to deal with what we would also call a scarcity of appropriate resources.
Susan, I would like to ask you, what is the actual definition of osteoporosis, which I think would be really helpful when we talk about osteoporosis, to know exactly what that is and is it really occurring for us?
Well, that's a very interesting point because the definition has evolved over time, and there's a couple of different definitions. The first definition, and the one that I think is probably still the best, is a bone that has a certain weakness, such a weakness that it's susceptible to needless fracture or to easy fracture. Like an osteoporotic fracture is considered one that occurs like when, like with a fall from standing height. In other words, it was a simple way to distinguish the bones that were, for whatever reason, had developed a weakness so that they fractured easily. Then a few, you know, in the late 80s, they developed this idea of actually when they could measure bone densities, they developed this idea that, well, maybe we can pick a bone density and say if you're at this bone density, you don't have osteoporosis. If you're lower than this, you do have it. And most often today, people think of osteoporosis as defined by bone density. For example, the minus 2.5 standard deviations from young women. In other words, if your bone density is significantly different than that of a young woman, they say you have osteoporosis. And this, everyone has heard probably the 2.5 T-score, which is a standard deviation measure. But we know that that definition doesn't work so well because it's very interesting, Cheryl. 80% of all fractures, in many studies, it has shown 80% of fractures occur in people who don't have osteoporosis. In other words, who don't have osteoporosis by bone density. Their bone density is better than what the scientists have called osteoporotic, and yet the vast majority of fractures occur in this population. So the definition commonly is by bone density, but it's really, I think a better definition is this one where there might be some low bone density, but there's a susceptibility to fracture.
And that's such an important point, that there's so much more to risk of fracture, which is really the concern about osteoporosis,
right?
Because that can lead to, you know, fractures and hospitalization and side effects, and that's where it can really be lead to an ongoing chronic.
Well, that's right, because, I mean, osteoporosis, without fractures, in my mind, there's no osteoporosis, because it's all made up to say, well, at this point, we're going to say your bone density is very low, and we're going to call it osteoporotic. But the value of osteoporosis is it's bone that is cannot stand up to the daily wear and tear, that cannot hold its strength for the average amount of activity that's put on it. And so many women are needlessly frightened. In fact, one of my favorite endocrinologists and also a person that I introduced you to, Dr. Geraldine Pryor, is a famous endocrinologist in Vancouver, and she simply does not treat people till they fracture because you cannot know who's going to fracture by bone density alone. And so the bone density definition of osteoporosis, one should be very leery of and not worry themselves about it terrifically, but rather look at multiple risk factors that are going to make you vulnerable to fracture because the end point is fracture.
So I have two points that I just want you to address before I forget them, and then we can move on to some other fascinating information you will be sharing. My two points are the role of menopause as a risk factor for osteoporosis and the role of hormones, hormone replacement or bioidentical hormones is the best options for, repairing and helping to prevent bone loss.
Well, menopause, it's very clear that when the estrogen, progesterone, and whatever forces else are involved, when a woman comes to the end of fertility, when nature says, look, you can no longer get pregnant, that the adjustment to those new hormones is associated with a period of rapid bone loss. And it's the first few years before the last period and the first few years after, maybe even up to 4 or 5 years after, that the average woman loses 10% of her bone mass. Before that, she might have been losing, she might have been stable or losing just a bit. We actually begin bone loss much earlier than we have thought about it. And actually, we lose muscle right along with bone. And this, you know, we peak and maybe in our 20s, and then we start losing both muscle and bone. And so, but the real accelerated loss, the notable loss, comes at menopause. What's interesting there is a lot of that loss is actually the first year before the last period. So it's like when you start to have symptoms of your regular periods, maybe a little bit of symptoms that things are changing, that's when the bone loss begins and is actually quite rapid. So the first year before and several years after, there's a window. The interesting caveat with that is while the average woman loses 10% of her bone mass, some thin women lose 20%. And I would say to thin women that they pay really special attention to do as much as they can to limit the menopausal bone loss. It's a very natural process. It is not a problem if a person has plenty of peak bone mass. They just experience this loss and then they go on to have, there's plenty of bone strength left. In fact, there's been some interesting study suggestion, if the bone is healthy, if that structure is healthy, you can support a lot of bone loss and still have very viable bones. So menopause is a period of rapid bone loss. It's a good time to perk up and say, look, I really should do something like Susan Brown's Better Bones program to make sure I limit this loss. There's also certain tests you can do, like these bone resorption markers we really like. You can read about them on our website, betterbones.com, these simple urine tests that can tell you just how high your rate of bone loss is, and you can work to really modify that with these nutritional therapies, with an alkaline diet, with exercise. I would say the only woman I saw who didn't lose any bone during menopause was a yoga teacher who taught like 2 classes a day. Hmm. She did a lot of exercise, plus yoga helps to bring certain equanimity to the nervous system, certain peacefulness, which is helpful for bone. Now, you want me to talk? So, Cheryl, you want my opinion on estrogen therapy, on bioidentical? Yeah. Or?
Yes, I do.
Well, this is very interesting. And, you know, this is part of the world where everyone has their different opinions. But certainly, remember, I'm an anthropologist. We really strive to reproduce whatever nature did. We kind of have this belief that nature has had millions of years of enviable experience and that we try to do what is natural, physiological, when at all possible. Now, it's true that all of us, as we move on and get elderly, we may find, wow, I've got to use this drug because my kidney's not functioning well, or I have to use this drug because whatever. And that's all well and good, but in a physiological approach, we try to work with nature, maximize nature, get to the root causes and solve the problems, not to intervene with unnatural therapies. So, that being said, estrogen therapy in particular has been used for many, many years. And as you know, 40 years ago, it was the biggest selling drug on the market. And then finally, a number of years ago, they actually did a study on estrogen in postmenopausal women. They looked at heart disease, they looked at bone, and they had to stop the study because it was too dangerous, that they were getting too many cancers, too much heart disease, which they didn't expect. And so out of that, there was a realization at that time that estrogen could help hold off menopausal bone loss, but the couple things. One, the minute you stopped it, you lose everything you gained. And two, it was too dangerous to use forever, for a long period of time. It's sort of like the bone drugs today. They'll stop bone loss, but it's too dangerous to use forever. Now, people have come and said, okay, well, let's use natural hormone therapy. Let's do a hormone that looks just like what the body produces instead of a hormone made from the urine of horses, for example. And this is called bioidentical hormone therapy. And I certainly think if one is ever going to use hormone therapy, and certainly in women who lose ovarian function before the age of menopause, we believe it's very wise to do hormone therapy, to go right up to the natural age of menopause. Using it after menopause, you've got several different camps. You know, some people believe, like Susan Summers, that it's going to hold the key to youthfulness. Our analysis is that estrogen, whether it's natural or whether it's synthetic, is very proliferative to tissue. Its function has to do with the proliferation of tissue, and that we do not, and we see that even if you take your risk for breast cancer, it is a greater risk even if you start menstruating earlier in your life or if you have menopause later. It's a question of lifelong exposure to estrogen that causes these risks. So we see no reason to think that natural estrogen therapy past the age of when nature said it's good to have this stimulation, I don't see that it's viable. Number one, the benefit on bone fracture reduction is probably 25%. Our research suggests that adequate vitamin D and these other nutrients could do as well as that. And number two, that it's risky. I see many, many cases of people developing breast cancer. And I personally do not endorse it. There may be cases, and in fact, if you look at the literature, if you even look at the package inserts, they'll say use it for the shortest period of time possible and for as needed to treat symptoms. And these are symptoms of, you know, the woman who has intractable menopause, like, I just can't bear it, I'm just having too much hot flashes, too many mood swings. Many of these people do estrogen for a while. And so it's kind of like the new age, you know, are we going to, can we do better than nature? You know, that's what it is. Can we do better than nature? And some people love it, do really well. Other people have had bad experiences. I just must say that I haven't seen ever a time in history that estrogen therapy was used and came out free of any damaging effects when you look at the long-term studies. So well, what's your take on that, Cheryl? I know you're all about maintaining youth and rejuvenation, and what's your thought on the estrogen?
Well, I concur with you, Susan. You know, I think there are a lot of risks and dangers. I think it's been overrated. I also believe we have many options that can support our health, support our hormones, support our bones, as you're doing, without putting ourselves at risk. And I have some data that also shows that the use of estrogens, whether it's in a bioidentical hormone form or HRT, which basically are the same estrogens these days, pose some serious risks of increased, you know, breast cancer, lung, colon, uterine, ovarian. So why do we need to put ourselves at risk for, like you said, minimal results, when we have so many other options that are in more harmony with nature and supports us for the long term?
Right.
So that's where I'm at, too.
Yeah, well, we've come to the same conclusion. And, boy, I've looked at the data a lot. And, you know, and we kind of get back to everybody's individual choice, you know. I mean, you can make that choice. But we'll try to work with nature and really respect that immense intelligence and the millions of years of natural selection that have led to this.
Right, absolutely. And I think the more we support and nurture and allow the body to have the key energies, whether it's from food or from herbs, from exercise, that really enhance function, we have this capacity, and that is what I particularly find exciting, and that's where I'm focusing on this rejuvenation model. It's like let's use the wisdom that has been handed down to us from generations or from leading-edge research with genomics and how we can optimize our body's ability to function.
Right. I think that's an excellent idea, and there's so much we can do.
So let's talk about what more we can do. And I know you have been looking at the role of muscle mass and bone health links. So let's explore that a bit.
You know, that's so interesting because we in our culture, we tend to get very focused on one aspect and sort of a linear thing, and we get kind of stuck. Let's look in this tunnel down at bone health. But if we step back, we see the body is one total functioning unit and that all the parts work together. And most interestingly, really, the bone and the muscle are one single unit. You can look at it that way, and it's very effective. And as you've got the muscle there attached to these tendons, the tendons attached to the bone. Every time you work a muscle, that tendon pulls on the bone. It creates a certain bending of the bone and a certain movement of fluid in the bones. And what we know is that as you build muscle, you build bone. And as you lose muscle, you lose bone. And the way we build bone is through showing the bone that they need to be strong because there's work for them to do. And we show that by the muscles pulling on them. So what this means for the individual is, as I'm going along life and I say, gee, I'm getting weaker. You know, those cans are harder to open. My grip strength isn't so great. I find I can't stand up so quickly. I find I can't jump so high. All of those are natural processes, but they're associated with bone loss. Muscle loss is associated with bone loss. And the corollary, of course, is if you say, well, look, I want to do something special to encourage my bone, then we encourage muscles, both with nutrients, with physical activity. And we can talk about the kinds of physical activity that might help the hip more or the spine more. But the physical activity, in fact, I was just at this conference I mentioned, and one of the researchers looked at childhood bone health, and he absolutely said 100% of the studies show the link between exercise and bone strength. And it's irrefutable that that is one of the simplest, most important things you can do to maintain all of your youthfulness. Now, this doesn't need to be like weightlifting, actually. We're now seeing that ancient exercises like Tai Chi, yoga, Qigong, they bring energy into the body, they work the muscles, they stimulate a calm nervous system, and they also stimulate bone as well as muscle development. So there's a wide range of exercise, but physical activity, showing the body you need it, building muscle strength, is very important for bone. Mm-hmm. And sure, let me just say, sure, the average person, if you're sitting there saying, well, yada, yada, this is all interesting, the average person, as they go from 35 to 85, will lose practically half of their muscle and half of their bone. And if you look at older people, you're going to see that. And we, each of us, would do well to say, how do I want to end up in 20, 30, 40, 50 years? You know? And so pay attention. That's a natural, if you do nothing, that's how you're going to end up. And if you do very careful nutrition, if you alkalize your chemistry through the consumption of lots of fruits, vegetables, nuts, and seeds, if you take the appropriate nutrients, and keep physically active, you don't have to incur that great of a loss. And even 90-year-olds have been made as strong as 50-year-olds with physical activity by William Evans, this physician. So there's a lot of possibilities there at any age, but keep in mind the bone-muscle link.
And it's interesting that studies are showing that the yoga, Tai Chi, Qigong, are also benefiting the bone, because we do think that bone and muscle mass have to do with weight training, which I actually right. do think it's a good idea, but there are lots of ways that we can rebuild our muscle mass and strengthen our muscle mass. And I've shared before on different shows that this has been a goal of mine several years ago. I noticed I was losing my muscle mass. So we notice it in our arms as we get older. So
right.
I was determined to build more muscle mass, which has never been a strength of mine. I mean, some women have really good muscles. I always had poor tone. Anyway, I set upon a program of going to the gym, working with weights. I actually worked with the trainer just 30 minutes, a couple of times a week, with tremendous results. Of course, adding some whey protein, making sure I had protein, so I had the
right.
nutrients as well as the exercise. And it amazed me, Susan, that I actually was able to do that. And we can build that muscle mass at any age. That's what's so exciting.
Exactly. That's a very important thing to remember, right? And And not to make excuses, you know, we have to really bite the bullet and say, how do I want to end up? We have the potential to do that. But a lot of time, we spend our time making excuses. Well, I can't exercise today. I don't have time. I got to do this. I have to do that. Or I could never accomplish that. So we have endless potential, but we need to focus our attention, just like you did with your exercise program.
And do you have a recommendation for women that is the most effective way to build muscle mass?
Well, like you said, it really depends on the personality. Like you could say, obviously, if you stress them, you know, you stress them when you break down the muscle, you build new muscle. And so, like lifting weights, if you lift a light weight, you aren't going to break down as much muscle. But if you lift, you've seen these studies where you lift the maximum you can lift, you only have to do a few repetitions, the muscle becomes fatigued, it starts to regenerate. A couple days later, you can do that exercise again. You can build strength. Certainly, weight training is a fast way because we put unusual demand on the muscle. But there's many people that isn't suited to their personality, or do they have a physical issue that they can't do it. Therefore, we see that there's nice ways, like with yoga or qigong or tai chi, that actually bring energy into the body. Don't just spend energy out. Bring energy into the body, and at the same time, build muscle. If you think about it, standing on one leg, and you put a stress on that muscle and that bone, and working the other leg. I mean, there's many, many. I think the ancient modalities are very good because what we forget is that we lose energy. Our system loses energy as we age. In fact, the Chinese have calculated how much we lose every decade after 30. Mm-hmm. And so if it feels good to you to do weight training, I say do it. If it doesn't, do one of these other more gentle modalities that actually bring energy into the body. Mm-hmm. We're using a vibration platform. For example, in my case, I wanted to keep as much muscle mass up as possible, but I didn't want to take the time to go to the gym. And I also, in a period, was very fatigued and didn't feel I had the energy to spend going to a gym. So I use a vibration platform, which is very nice, which causes the muscles to fire 32 times a second. It quickly fatigues the muscles, allows, and the principle is you tire the muscle, you fatigue it, it'll build new strength. So, yeah, there's many modalities. I always say find something you really like. The guideline basically is, you know, trying to walk at least a half an hour every day. And, you know, if you can get one of those little meters and walk the 10,000 steps, great idea. A great idea. And then to do some kind of strength training, maybe two or perhaps even better, three times a week, whether they're with some weights, whether it's with some yoga, whether it's qigong. That sort of thing will be helpful.
And I just want to say about the 10,000 steps. I actually interviewed Dr. Michael Roizen a while back, and he's passionate about the 10,000 steps. And every phone now, every smartphone actually has a program built in where you can count your steps. So
right.
You don't even have to get a pedometer. You can just use your phone to
exactly.
Be inspired. You know, it just gives you that ability to actually see what's going on, and then just set your goals and attain them. So just look at the program.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
People listening,
it's simple
in.
Now.
Yeah.
And I find it just around my office on a regular work day with my high level of activity, I only have 5,000 steps. And I really have to get outside and do some walking, or people would have to do a treadmill, whatever, be physically active outside to get that 10,000 steps.
So more wonderful advice, and I want us to talk about another area that you've been investigating, and that's the effect on bones from women who are very thin. And we can talk about people who have excess weight as well as people who have low weight. What do we need to know about that?
Well, this is really interesting, too, because weight is very linked to bone mass, and we've always thought that heavier women, because every day they put more, with every step, they put greater demand on the bone to say, look, now, bone, you've got to carry around 250 pounds instead of just, you know, 150 pounds. That certainly builds stronger bones. And so it's very interesting. Generally, thin women will have lower bone density. And if you are thin and you lose weight as you age, like after menopause, that's especially put you at risk for fracture. But thin women don't necessarily have to fracture. Well, there's the whole question about how they measure bone density with thin women. Maybe we can talk about that. Thin women are not measured fairly. But just to stick to this very question, so basically, the thin women will have a lower reading. The average weight woman will have a better bone density. Heavy women do. The bone really reflects a little bit the weight. But if you get into being overweight or have metabolic syndrome, you find health issues, if you're significantly overweight, if you're bordering on the obese, which is surprisingly, you know, a large percent of our population, you end up having weakness in bone because of these metabolic situations where you may have high insulin, high blood sugar, a lot of free radical damage going on. So it's not just to say the more weight, the better, that there's definitely problems with being overweight for bone, especially if it's associated with metabolic syndrome or metabolic problems. And underweight is often associated with another whole series of syndromes like weak digestion, weak assimilation, maybe food sensitivities, maybe low adrenal function. And the most interesting thing I've found with thin women is a tendency to worry. And, you know, not that there aren't heavier women and normal weight women who worry, but there's ancient knowledge from the Ayurvedic medicine of India millennium ago said that there's a certain thin body type that tends to be worried, very fast changing. This body type the bones tend to dry up, so to speak. And so thin women should pay special attention, not only to avoid excessive menopausal bone loss, but to work to see ways to calm the nervous system, like meditation is a classic way, yoga, tai chi, to see how to nourish the body and deal with a tendency to have weak digestion, because weak digestion really affects bone. You must be able to absorb all the nutrients to have good bone strength. So weight is an important issue. And lastly, if you lose weight, you're going to lose bone. So, and if you're young, like these young people who may become anorexic, they lose a lot of weight, they lose a lot of bone. But if their hormones, if their hormones come back, if they get their periods back, they can regain that bone. When we get older, when we get into menopause, if you lose weight, it's very hard to regain the bone back. And that's a very important thing to consider. If you're doing a weight loss program, you should do it with adequate exercise, adequate nutrients, and like you mentioned, that protein which you need to build and keep the muscles, as well as all the minerals and vitamins that are important to bone. And you need to alkalize. You know, a lot of the weight loss diets are very acid-forming. High meat diets, they cause a lot of bone loss. And so you want to take care. If you lose weight, you're going to lose bone, so be careful with it.
You know, it's so interesting because your whole approach, which has always been so sensible and so profound to me, is understanding the needs of the body. It's a holistic approach. Bones aren't separate. They don't exist out there disconnected from what you're thinking, feeling, eating, you know, absorbing, the whole process of our body and how we support our health is impacting our bones as well, and vice versa. So we need to really have a systematic and functional medicine model, address all the underlying root cause issues. But the thing I wanted to comment on, it's like if you have too much protein, which may be on more of the paleo side of things, which is a popular diet, or too little protein, which goes to the vegan and potentially vegetarian side, mm-hmm. both extremes can create imbalances that can lead to loss of bone.
Well, you certainly do see it. Like the vegan, I literally shudder when I see somebody comes to me on a vegan diet, because it's very difficult to maintain bone density on a diet like that, because we don't, well, first place, the vegan diet is it's not natural. I mean, the only people that ever did it were some monks in the Himalayas there who were didn't have the stresses we have. And even a vegetarian, but so a vegetarian diet can be fine, but you just have to take the time to cook. You have to get the beans. You have to make sure you have all that manganese, zinc, copper, which we get so easily from meat. So, yeah, that's a very important part, and we have to be careful with that. The protein, at this recent meeting, there was a lot of talk about protein, and sometimes people read my book, The Acid Alkaline Food Guide, and they say, well, I should cut protein, because protein is acid-forming. As we burn those sulfur-containing amino acids in protein, we produce an internal sulfuric acid. But it's only the excess protein that's acid-forming. And so we really need, what these researchers are saying, are at least 1 gram per kilo. And so, you know, it's usually 50, 60, even 70 grams, 150 pound person. Yeah, so, if you weighed 150, it would be about 68, 70 grams of protein. So you want to have
which
enough.
Which is the content, it's the protein content within a food. It's not necessarily the weight of a piece of steak.
Yeah, it's the grams of protein. Yeah, the grams of protein.
So, which is a distinction, because we have to actually go in and look at the protein content of any food.
Yeah, that's like a serving of fish or chicken and turkey might have 30 grams of protein.
Yeah.
So on our website, betterbones.com, we have the list of protein foods,
yeah.
Actually. So that's
and
right. So we.
I just want to say it's a good time to let everyone know about your website again. I just really want to be sure people understand that you have put together such tremendous information and resources. You have your books, you have your CDs, you've got all sorts
of... Lots
of
DVDs,
And DVDs, rather, and then you've got all sorts of tools. I mean, it's the most... I think it's the place to go to get the whole story on bones and what you need to do to support optimal bone health. So that's betterbones.com, and you have a newsletter. Everyone needs to go there, sign up for the newsletter, and just get this ongoing knowledge and research that you're doing. It really is the go-to place as far as I'm concerned, because you aggregate information as well, so people can just go to your site and you'll get the latest and updated research and information and strategies that you are seeing success with in your practice.
Exactly, and we appreciate you making that effort to let the women know. We have really developed the most comprehensive site on bone health, on natural bone health in the country, looking at the nutritional and lifestyle factors, in the world, actually.
In the world.
And I have a blog, a little newsletter that goes to several hundred thousand people every week. And if you go to my website, betterbones.com, you can sign up for that, or if you call our office at 888-206-5320, we'll sign you up. And it's really helpful because you'll learn all the latest news on nutrition and bone health, and it'll kind of inspire you to think about how you can better take care of yourself. So, yeah, go to betterbones.com
And your book, I mean, your book is still a classic, your Better Bones book. That's a book everyone should read if they really want to understand the bones. And
yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? What we said many years ago is still.
Oh, it's
still
even
true,
truer,
yeah.
I think, than ever before.
Yeah.
And
look at the Acid Alkaline Food Guide is a very popular book. And just to say that pH balance is important for maintaining both muscle and bone, immune competence, disease prevention, to have that chemistry in a position that favors all the enzymes, all the protein development. We're learning a lot, and it's very interesting to see more and more that we can each do individually with our diet and lifestyle.
So one question, I am just thinking of some patients who I know are struggling with some chronic health issues and have really lost a lot of weight. Of course, all those people who are addressing cancer through chemotherapy, you tend to lose weight on that protocol. What would be your recommendations for people who are very thin, who have lost muscle mass as well as bone, have compromised digestion? Where should they begin?
Well, that's an interesting question. And I certainly, on the website, I wrote a little document called 10 Steps to Stronger Digestion. That's really handy because it incorporates the ancient Eastern Chinese medicine perspective on how to build digestive strength by having hot and cooked food and whatnot. So that's helpful to look at. Certainly, if one has a significant muscle loss, I look carefully at the supplements and not only use vitamins and minerals and essential fats, but also use amino acids. Like you were mentioning, proteins, like you could do a complete protein like your whey or this pea protein or whatever, and also to look at the individual amino acid profiles. There are some of these combinations of essential amino acids and adding a little more leucine that can really help. Yep, that's there are particular protocols for sarcopenia, the loss of muscle, and they're effective for bone too. And that's right, rich protein, rich amino acids, maybe some special supplementations of amino acids.
And the good word, I mean, the real message you have that I think inspires everyone is that we can help restore bone function, and we may not be able to, as you said, rebuild bone density, but we can restore healthy bone tissue. And,
right.
Right, and that's the other piece that people need to understand. It's not all about having strong bones. It's having healthy bone metabolism and bone.
Well, it's not all about having a higher bone density.
We
want to have stronger bones, but bone is half protein collagen matrix, and that's what gives it the strength. And so we want to have those minerals in place, but we don't worry if the minerals go down so much. We're looking at the protein matrix. In fact, they've developed a new device. They call it the osteoprobe. They can put this needle through your skin and hit the bone, and they're believing they can detect the strength of the collagen. So I don't think that's very far away in being able to measure bone strength. In the meantime, we know if you fractured, you want to pay special attention. You want to get right on my website and start doing the Better Bones program. And if you haven't fractured, then you still are very conscious, take a lot of care to keep that protein matrix healthy, as well as the bone density, but bone density does not tell the full story. And we never like to lose excessive, but 0.5% to 1% a loss a year after menopause, in your 60s is really common. We see many people who can halt and build bone, but that depends if they put the pieces together and do the exercise, alkalize, do all the nutrients. That's right. There's much more to bone than bone density.
And do you think the bone density test is a test worth taking?
Well, you know, there's a whole lot of new research showing the many inaccuracies in those tests, and just to say you need a 5 or 6% change just to make sure it's not placement on the machine. I think it's fine to get some baselines, and you may work with that a little through menopause and then on your life as you go on. I like better the bone resorption markers, the little urine markers.
Mm-hmm.
We sometimes do those. We might have some baseline bone densities and occasionally do that, but we look more at the bone breakdown markers to see if you've been able to halt excessive bone loss. And these were markers like the NTX test that were developed to see if the drug therapies are working, actually. So they're a very nice functional test of bone breakdown.
Because you're looking in present time and you're really seeing what's going on.
And you're looking at the collagen matrix. You're seeing how much is the collagen matrix breaking down.
Yes, yeah. You know, we only have a couple of minutes, so it's more just a quick response to my question, which is a whole show in itself. Can you give us some thoughts about the bisphosphonate drugs that are the main approach from the traditional medicine model?
Well, you know, I got right on my desk here, if I can find it, some Finnish researchers who have talked about over-medicalization, the overuse of medicines, and one of the major researches is with osteoporosis. And their point is fractures occur because of falls. Pay better attention to falls. Their article is about over-medicalization and over-diagnosis. And here is their summary, which I think is so elegant. They say, and this is Dr. Jervinin. It was published in the British Medical Journal in May of 2015. And it's about over-diagnosis of bone frailty in the quest to prevent hip fractures. And here's what he says. Pharmacotherapy, drug therapy for hip fracture prevention, can achieve at best a marginal reduction in hip fractures at the cost of unnecessary psychological harms, serious medical adverse events, and foregone opportunities to have greater impact on the health of older people. As such, it is an intellectual fallacy which we will live to regret. And I feel clearly that this man, this doctor is right, that this is a, we've gotten all wound up in this technology, this pharmacology, when really we've, and we have failed at a great cost to women and all the many women who are frightened. The hip fracture rate is actually going down, and yet more and more women are frightened every day, begin to see themselves as ill, begin to see themselves as crumbling. And there's, and we have missed the opportunity to go back to how do we have our natural birthright of lifelong healthy bones.
Which
and
we
so,
can create, which we can create at any age of our life.
Yes, we can certainly do a great deal to recreate that at any age, exactly.
Well, Susan, we've come to the end of our conversation. I am just so grateful. It's been a wonderful conversation, and I'm sure everyone has been inspired and wants, you know, want to, and everyone will want to learn more, and that's where they just need to go to your website, bitterbones.com.
Bitterbones.com will do the trick, yep.
So much there. So everyone, go check out bitterbones.com and get Dr. Susan Brown's newsletter. And Susan, thank you for the wonderful work you're doing.
Well, it's my pleasure, Gail. Congratulate you too on your big effort to educate women and how they can take better care of themselves and empower themselves.
That's the name of the game. So so thank you, Dr. Susan Brown, and thank you for listening to all of my listeners today. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You're listening to What Women Must Know. And remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.